everybody. This is Armand DeMille.
And this is Roberta Maria Atti.
Here with you with the positive mind, WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial in New York City.
Happy New Year, everyone.
Happy New Year to you, Roberta.
Thank you.
And it's magic.
Absolutely.
It's all magic. You know, a little while ago, we had through the nice gift of Marty, Marty Resnick had told me about this magician downtown I should go see. And she said, there's this man down there, he's kind of extraordinary. So I went downtown to see him, and then I said, Roberta, there's this man downtown, you got to go downtown and see. And you went down.
I did, with my kids.
Right, and there on 15th Street was Eric Walton. Eric Walton, who was an actor,
mm-hmm.
and a conjurer, and a magician, and I was very, very impressed. It opened up a whole question about what is magic, and what is it about magic, and why does magic exist, and why do we believe in magic? And luckily, we got in touch with Eric, or Roberta did, and invited Eric to join us on the program, and he's with us today. Or he was with us a minute ago, but I can't see him anymore.
Where did he go?
I don't know. But that's Eric. I don't know.
That guy is good.
He'll be back in a second.
Mm.
Anyway, you know, magic seems so remarkable in many ways. But, you know, if you imagine yourself being originally on the savannah, or being an aborigine, or being a primitive somewhere early in the history of mankind.
You mean a pre-technological human, something
yeah,
like that?
Way pre-tech.
Mm-hmm. Technology is magic in itself.
I mean, dinosaur time, I mean, what happened? What was magic to them? If you're a dog in the world, or if you're a cat, you don't even think in terms of magic. You just think there are things I understand and there are things I don't understand. that's all you think. An apple falls from the tree. It's because eventually apples fall from the tree. If I shake the tree, the apple falls. That's all the magic I know. If a rock falls on my head, I don't know where it came from necessarily, and I don't understand it. At a certain point in our development, we didn't understand.
I think what mattered when we were that innocent was only the consequences.
That's right.
Not the reasons. And then we became so curious about the reasons for things. I think that's evolution.
Well, I think part of what evolution was is if we could figure out the reasons, then we could eat better.
We could control the consequences.
Right, we could control the consequences. We could find animals. You know,
yep.
I could find out a way if I could throw this spear.
But that destroys the magic, in a way.
It's not so much, but it was never magic in the first place. So trying to...
I could argue with that, Armand. If you don't know the reason of something, then that's magic, because it happens and you don't know why it happens
but
or how.
But I don't think my cat thinks that magic exists.
Right, well, yes.
My cat just says it is or it isn't. And
yes.
If it makes a big noise, I should run under the bed.
And children are like that.
Yes, children always run under the bed. Okay, but now then we got smart.
Mm-hmm.
Then we figured out there is a cause for everything, and it's run by these gods.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
We invented gods.
To explain magic.
To explain what we didn't understand.
Mm-hmm.
So all magic is now in the hand of gods. And then when we couldn't,
God has been referred to as the great magician. That's true.
Yeah. And all the different gods.
Right.
You know, Artemis and Mars and
sure.
and Janus and, you know, all the other gods you could pick at each
and
god.
And the spells that the goddesses would put on the gods. That's magic, too.
All magic. But we went through life, and there were certain things caused by gods and other things not caused by gods, and we get through, and there were just things we couldn't understand, like static electricity. What are you like as a human who is suddenly touches another human, and you meet another human, and you've both been petting some aboriginal gorilla or something, right? And, you know, way back when.
Aboriginal gorilla.
I don't know.
I like that.
Cro-Magnon somebody.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, you're running your finger through the hand, and then suddenly you pick up static electricity, and then you kiss them. And they, you get electricity. Now you said, ooh.
This must be my soulmate.
This must be my soulmate, because we didn't understand. We said, electricity is magic.
Right.
And therefore, everything to do with electricity is magic. The stingray uses some kind of magic process. The firefly. Lightning itself was considered to be the gods throwing rods.
Sure.
You know of lightning. A rainbow is magic. Nobody understood what a rainbow is. You know, and we knew gold was at the end of the rainbow. What would we have thought of back then, or even back as the 1800s, of somebody flying?
Mm-hmm.
There's somebody up in the sky. They're flying. What if you had two walkie-talkies and you went back to the 14th century or 15th century and you said to somebody, here, take this and go in the other castle, right, and I'll talk to you from where I am. Just press that button. What would the response be to see a voice coming out of a machine?
Yep.
Well,
that would have been considered magical.
So we have magic is something that we that goes with that which we don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also we believe magic is more than that. Magic is something we want to exist. And that it does something for us in its form. So now let's go to Eric Walton. Eric Walton, who is, I think, one of the finest magicians I've ever seen, who is also more than a magician. He is an actor who is going to be starring in something we're going to talk about. And he's a poet. And a wonderful poet. And so my gift for the new year, our gift for the new year, is to start you off by introducing you to Eric before he speaks to us about anything, is to introduce you with his poem.
Mm-hmm.
Eric has a poem. He has a poem that he read during this performance that had everybody in the audience just mesmerized. Mesmer was the perfect word for this one.
Yeah, or spellbound.
Spellbound, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
It's a story about Harry Houdini, the magician, who runs into a card shark named
O'Malley?
O'Malley, right.
Jack O'Malley.
Jake right. O'Malley, right. So now this is going to be, my friends, here on WBAI, the program that explains everything, the program that teaches you about the human mind. Lay back, sit back, and enjoy some poetry. We're about to give you, I think, one of the finest speaking humans on the planet, reading you a beautiful reciting.
Yeah,
he's not reading anything. A beautiful poem. And so I bring you, my friends, without further ado, Eric Walton, who will start off, kick off our whole thing just going right into the poem. And here are Eric Walton.
Grant me now your undivided attention and a story I will relate. It's a cautionary tale about fraud prevention set in autumn 1908. The tale that I now offer you takes place in London town, on Belmont Street to be exact, in a tiny little pub, though one of great renown, a place called Mickey and Jack's. Now Mickey and Jack's had a sterling reputation among hustlers, con men, and cheats, as an excellent place to enjoy some libation and to mingle with the swindling elite. Among the many patrons that Mickey and Jack's did boast was the card cheat Jake O'Malley, a well-bred fellow more cunning than most, who always entered from the alley. They say Jake stood quite apart from his fellow card sharks in that he was a man refined. For Jake, cheating was an art, and he always got his mark with a gentleman's smile and a hustler's mind. Yes, Jake O'Malley was nothing short of an artist whose poise made other cheats blush. He was not only the quickest, but also the smartest, whose forte was dealing a straight flush. Now it seems that on one chilly October Saturday night, as Jake was sipping his martini, a man walked in, looking to cloy his appetite. The man was Harry Houdini. Harry Houdini, escape artist, showman, and conjurer, a man known far and wide, was there in Mickey and Jack's among con men and wanderers. And whom should he sit beside? You guessed it, ladies and gents, the notorious card shark Jake, a man of such nefarious ambition. He tipped his hat, they exchanged names in a handshake, and Jake asked, "Aren't you that famous magician?" "Magician?" asked Harry. "Why, yes, famous, I wouldn't deny it. In fact, many say I'm the best. Have you an interest in magic? Would you like to try it? If so, there's a book I can suggest." "Oh, no," said Jake. "Magic is not where my interest lies, though I admit I have high regard for the subterfuge and artifice you utilize, and of course I love what you do with cards. I, too, make a living with cards. Gambling is my craft and trade. Some say I'm the finest in the land. Why, even you, Mr. Houdini, might be impressed with the fortune I've made. Tell me, are you a gambling man?" "I ask not to gratify my own curiosity, but to answer for all card handlers the question of who has greater skill and virtuosity, the magician or the gambler. I, of course, maintain that a gambler's skill is paramount to that of a mere entertainer, and I'd be willing to wager a fair amount. In fact, here's 10 grand as a retainer." He reached into his pocket, and without a second thought pulled out £10,000 in cash. Houdini pondered briefly how much money he had brought as Jake sat, stared, and twirled his mustache. As the two men sat, the silence was contagious. Everyone there was mesmerized. Placing a bet with Jake was really quite outrageous. Could Houdini be that unwise? But Harry was confident in his skill, his prowess, his wit, so he said, "Tell me, what do you propose? I'll accept any challenge that you contrive or submit, as long as you explain it in prose." "Well, all right, Mr. Houdini. Here's what I have in mind," said Jake, not willing to give up verse. "Simply take a shuffled deck and cut to 4 of a kind, and if you'd like, I'll try it first." He picked up the deck and cut to the aces, 1, 2, 3, and 4, diamonds, clubs, hearts, then spades. Here was skill such as Houdini had never seen before, from the Far East to the Everglades. It was, however, too late for Harry to turn back, so he placed his money right next to Jake's, then stated dryly, "You, sir, seem to have quite a knack, which is important with these kind of stakes. Your speed and precision leave little to be desired. Have you been practicing long? Your level of skill is not easily acquired. You must be a cheat. Am I wrong?" "It's a rhetorical question. Don't feel obliged to respond, but I really must confess an uneasy feeling that I am somehow being conned, but I shall persevere nonetheless." With these words, the intrepid Harry, composed, assured, serene, cut the deck not once, not twice, but thrice. He felt the top card, then turned it over. "A queen." "A queen," quipped Harry. "How very nice." Once again he cut the deck, his nimble fingers a-seeking a second queen to match the first, which is not easily done, especially without a peeking. Queens, you see, aren't easily coerced. And yet somehow he managed, for he cut to queen number 2, whom he nestled beside her sister, and said, "Well, I feel pretty good so far. How about you?" Jake replied, "Just cut the cards there, mister." Harry cut to the 3rd and penultimate queen and said, "Well, only one more remains. I cannot tell you what a singular pleasure it has been ridding you of your ill-gotten gains. Perhaps next time we could play a few hands of 5-card draw, maybe a round of fast and loose." He turned over the last card, and none could believe what they saw. Houdini had cut to a deuce. "Well, Harry, my lad, guess I'll be taking this off your hands," said Jake, reaching for the 20 thou. "You know, a man should really stick to that which he understands, not that it matters much now." "Thanks for the advice," said Harry, "but I'm a bit perplexed. Did I miss something along the way? Forgive me if I seem befuddled or somewhat vexed, but let us recap, if we may. The bet was not to cut to the 4 queens specifically, but simply to cut to 4 of a kind. Now please, turn over those cards," urged Harry beatifically, "and tell me what it is you find." Jake took a long, contemplative drag from his cigarette, then he threw it to the floor. He turned over the cards and, with disbelief and regret, found the deuces, 1, 2, 3, and 4. My dear Mr. O'Malley, or would you prefer Jake? The evidence seems fairly plain. Your eyes do not deceive, please make no mistake, but perhaps I should explain. Though you thought the queens had been tabled, clearly you were wrong. That would be an impossibility, because, of course, they've been here in my pockets all along, a testament to my agility. And if your expression of dismay is any indication, and trust me, sir, you look dismayed, you've not been privy to much true prestidigitation, I do hope an impression has been made. I must now take my leave of you. I can't afford to dally. You see, I have a train to catch. But tell me something. How does it feel, Mr. Jake O'Malley, to have finally met your match? He stepped outside and took a deep breath of the crisp autumn night, then walked to Victoria Station. As he strolled on insouciantly, he thought, I am quite grateful for my occupation. And these, ladies and gentlemen, are quite simply the facts about a magician, a gambler, and a little pub in London, a place called Mickey and Jack's.
I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. Eric Walton, talented man. Eric, welcome to WBAI.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. Oops.
Absolutely. Oh. Where am I? There you are. Now try again.
All right. Thank you very much. It's an absolute pleasure.
Yes. I mean, we must let people know that that is your English-speaking voice, but that's your trained voice, that you're really a Coloradian.
Well, Oklahoman by birth, New Yorker.
Tell me three things that happen in the capital of Oklahoma. I'm only kidding. It's part of Eric's
part of the show
performance. Eric, you know, you run into a lot of people when you do a magic show. Let's talk about magic for a moment.
Okay.
A magic show is illusion.
Yes.
It's illusion means what? I mean, it means.
Well, illusion is, sort of open to a lot of different interpretations, but in the context of what I do, it's probably best defined as, I think, by another magician, a very talented fellow by the name of Banachek, who referred to it as using his five senses to create the impression of a sixth. Mm-hmm. So in terms of the mind-reading stunts and that sort of thing, that's how it's best described. But then there are other elements to my show that are not, based on mind-reading and, you know, the paranormal necessarily. And for that, basically what
Let's go back to that for a moment.
Yeah.
Using your five senses,
mm-hmm.
right, to create an illusion of a sixth sense, the
right.
illusion that you are a mind reader, that you are in touch with extrasensory perception, that you have...
That I can somehow either predict or subvert your free will, that sort of thing, any number of things, that I can contact the spirits, that I can manipulate physical objects in a way, you know, that defies the known laws of physics and probability.
But all the manipulations that you do and all the manipulations you do not defy, right, the probabilities. I mean, you could, it's explainable.
Yes, perfectly explicable in terms of the way I handle the cards and all of that. It's only the illusion of magic, you know,
so,
as you said.
So really what you do is you find a way to cause a person to disbelieve their own perception in a way, because when I watched you, I knew you must have been doing something that I could not register with my senses.
Exactly, exactly. And if you didn't have that impression, it would mean that I wasn't doing my job very well.
Right.
So, yeah. No, I mean, the magician's job is to provide a very sort of narrow range of experience for the audience and to make sure that everything you perceive or that you are aware of is very carefully controlled by me and by the atmosphere and conditions that I create up there. So I want you to believe that you've seen things that you haven't. I want you to forget that you've seen things that you have seen. So it's really all about manipulation, really. Manipulation
of the senses.
Of the senses, of your perception, mm-hmm. and then, you know, the whole psychological element, too.
Sure.
You know, using language to obfuscate and to sort of draw people to inferences that aren't necessarily accurate mm-hmm. and that don't necessarily converge with the way things actually happen. But it's you know, people often think of magicians as people who just get up there and do tricks, but there's so many layers to it, and it's such a it's so just riven with complexity and subtlety and you know, every single movement is orchestrated and choreographed and it's all for a reason. You know what I'm saying? It's all to sort of funnel your perception into this very narrow sort of corridor where you're only seeing what I want you to see.
I loved the combination of your assertiveness with the audience and the gentleness with which you approach people. You're so kind and gentle, and yet you're so assertive that you just can't, no one can really not pay attention to you. You know, you really command the attention of the audience, but in a gentle way. It's fantastic.
Well, thank you.
I mean, and part of what we're hearing is not just, of course, what magicians do, it's what people do. When people meet at the beginning, what are they doing? They're creating illusions. You know, when you get a young couple who meets each other for the first time, the woman is creating an illusion, and if it's a man-woman couple, then the man is creating an illusion by the way you speak, by the way you present your evidence,
sure.
by the way you hold your body, by the makeup that you wear, by the padding that you wear, by the way you flex your body.
Perfumes.
Mm-hmm. All of that is illusory to kind of get you to a place of intimacy or intimate contact, which is
certainly
just what you're doing with expertise on a stage.
Yeah, no,
and
I mean,
with far less devious motive. I mean, you're doing it as a show. You're doing it as a show. For the rest of them, it's
well, I think when people are selling things to some extent, they create an illusion of something, or they might. You know, I think in a lot of relationships or interactions,
yeah,
that goes on.
I think wherever
it's
there's any element
control.
Of, yeah, and it's very pervasive. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, it's of course in advertising and in all forms of media, and even as you said, in interpersonal relationships. But you know, it brings to mind that you know there is an element, and I'm certainly not the first to make this observation. You know, of the performer audience relationship that is very analogous to seduction. You know, I step on stage and it's my job to seduce the audience into loving me and into like believing what I have to say and having confidence in me and having faith in me and my abilities and to sort of caress away any skepticism or mm-hmm. or you know, logical objections that might be likely to arise with you know, my various gifts, talents, and tricks.
Do you have in your mind, do you have classes of people, you know, when you see that, if you see a trouble spot, if you see the skeptic, which I can't imagine why skeptics pay money to go to a magic show
mm-hmm.
to, I guess, they want to prove how smart
Maybe
they are.
Maybe to prove, right.
They want to prove that they are intelligent. They want to prove that they can.
Yeah, I don't, you know, typically people like that won't actually pay money to see a show, but if I'm doing, you know, if I'm doing a show and an event and such a person, you know, happens to be there, you know, he doesn't mind sitting there and spending his time, you know, and rather wasting his time. Yeah. Yeah, and you know, as you know, I've often done performances where, you know, even during the performance, but you know, more often after, the spectators or the volunteers that I'm using on stage will tell me that they know exactly how I'm doing something. And more often than not, they're completely wrong and off track, but they have to grab onto something. You know what I'm saying? Like the idea that that something is being presented to them that might be a little bit beyond their understanding, or that might somehow cast them in a light of not being quite as clever as they would like to, you know, feel they are, is somehow threatening, you know, threatening to their intelligence, threatening to their, I don't know, existential security or something. And so they have to assert their power over me, basically, asserting that they know how things are done and that it's all perfectly explicable.
The same thing happens socially when people meet people. You know, the woman who meets a man at a bar and then goes to disarm him slowly by exposing the different weaknesses and the different parts of the illusion, you know, the story that he may tell, or just pulling it apart a little bit.
Right.
And the same with the man, with the woman trying to disarm the woman. It's like a competition. It's like, I want to take your illusion apart.
Right.
Now, there's one, and then on the other hand, there are those of us who want the illusion to exist.
Certainly.
I mean, I'm somebody who is I see illusions. I see how they're created. I want to suspend my disbelief to watch an artist like you. I mean, if you're one of the finest I've ever seen, maybe the finest person I've ever seen, because of the way your gracefulness and the way you present it.
Thank you.
I figured it was a gift. We're trying to work something out to make this a WBAI function.
Certainly.
You know, somewhere along the line, I want to get a BAI function to happen.
That would be great.
With Eric there, you know, to gift us. But to see the grace that you presented this with, and to see the way
But I think that the charm is what spell it's what works as a spell, because the charm just envelops you. You know, as Eric walks onto the stage, there is a charm about him that you just can't take your eyes off of him, and yet he only shows you the things that he wants you to see. And I could tell that, of course, there were some things you didn't want me to see, but I didn't want to see them anyway.
Right.
I was happy not to see them, because I, like Armand, love magic. I love the idea of it, and I love to suspend my rational mind.
Absolutely.
Give it a vacation for a while,
certainly,
you know? That's
certainly
what it's like for me.
Yeah, absolutely. No, and I think that, you know, that need, that desire to believe, if only for, you know, an hour and a half or 2 hours, to believe in this realm, this sort of supernatural, super rational realm, I think that need is ancient, you know. Like, I think it goes back to
Sure.
it goes back to, you know, when, you know, what you guys were talking about earlier, that sort of very early, sort of pre-technological, pre-agrarian even, sort of, you know, when we were, you know, living in caves and whatnot, and we would see, you know, we would see the wind act upon the grass and attribute that to, not to the wind necessarily, but to some sort of magical force or to some sort of deity, you know. So
sure, but even the birth of a child was something that people could not explain until very recently.
Yeah.
And everything seemed magical, of course. And I think that I actually have to admit it, that there was a part of me, Eric, that wondered if you really were doing the things that you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
The excellence of you is that I'm a very skeptical individual, and I think I don't think I'm that naive. I think I've seen a lot. I've been around the world a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
You were able to create that doubt in me.
Oh,
is he really a mind reader? You know?
That's great.
You did. You succeeded. Although there was the part of me that said, oh, come on.
But people say that about you too, Roberta. You know, people say that about you and your
and about
ability,
you, Armand.
Yeah, and your ability to see people. And you do see people in a mystical way that is the same kind of thing. It's not, you're not a mind reader, but you read things
sure.
that don't always make the most sense.
Mm-hmm.
This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, a little bit of music, and right back with Eric Walton.
Thank you.
McSmiley, I believe in magic. Nice. Roberta Maria Atti, Eric Walton, Armand DeMille, The Positive Mind, Tuesdays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays here at WBAI. Going to be with you today and tomorrow, talking about magic and the idea of magic. And Roberta and I were exploring the concept of magic, and funny things started happening, because as we started researching it, we began realizing that the beauty of magic is being able to relax your belief system, mm-hmm. and being able to relax it to a point where I was saying, what's the appeal of it? What's the appeal of it? And I think you came up with that, Roberta.
Well, I can only speak for myself, but the appeal for me is that when I suspend my rational mind, I feel more like a child, and therefore more like the world is a place where I can play, and it's a place of fantasy where, you know, somewhere over the rainbow. Mm-hmm. So I think that there's also an aspect of, if you can believe in magic, you are not completely an adult.
Now, that's a very important factor,
there's
I think.
Something very
so
reassuring
let me check this
about
with Eric.
That.
Eric, did you ever notice when people walk out of your show? I mean, I noticed everybody walking out of your show that one day, and the show's no longer around, by the way. When it comes back,
unfortunately,
we'll notify you on our website. We'll hook it up to our website so you can find out from that. But did you ever notice the smiles, the nature of the smiles? Because when I walked out of your show, I saw these beaming smiles. And I can only tell you there's been maybe two or three times in my life that I've seen smiles beaming so bigly.
Bigly, yes, it's
bigly,
true. Bigly, I like it, Armand. Bigly. That's fine. That's
right?
Fine.
Just bigly smiles. They were like from ear to ear.
True.
And it looked like, to me, I never thought about it, but it looked like children.
Yeah, you know, I think that is I think Roberta, you know, really hit the nail on the head there. It's, you know, there's something very just refreshing and invigorating about just yielding to that childlike fascination, just surrendering all logical objections and just experiencing something as if through the eyes of a child and you know, the beauty of that, of course, in a magic show is that it puts the audience right where I want them. You know what I'm saying? Where they've left their sort of objective, skeptical, cynical minds at the door, and they're just there to experience what's in front of them. You know what I'm saying? And what they perceive. And if, you know, one of my favorite parts of the show was afterwards going out to the lobby and shaking hands with people and you know, talking to people and seeing exactly what you're talking about, seeing the effect that the show, that just, you know, sitting in that darkened theater with a room full of strangers and just listening to someone talk and just surrendering to the experience of it, the joy that engendered in people was just so gratifying. You know, I mean, it was just there's nothing like it, and to experience that, you know, eight shows a week for me for as long as we did it was just breathtaking for me.
You know, Eric, you did a trick with my daughter, and she's a young lady, and you called her up. It was the first thing you did where you had someone else read her mind.
Oh, yes.
And you asked us not to reveal anything to her, and she's been asking me, of course, what did he do? And I refused
to
tell her.
Good for you,
Because that's what makes it fun. Not fun. There is something about surrendering to the mystery that puts someone else in charge, right? You don't you don't have control of everything.
Well,
and there's something about that is just, I think, and that's why, for as long as I could, as a mother, I upheld Santa or, you know, things like that.
Tooth fairies,
absolutely. And for as long as I could, because I knew that the day that would have been be explained away, something would have been lost that was very precious.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think also you we go into another area here, which is now we begin to understand a little more about why people, this is going to sound like we've changed subjects, but we haven't, why people like to fall in love. You see, falling in love is suspending your disbelief, mostly. Mostly the people who fall in love, especially love at first sight, they're saying, you know, I don't want to think about what I have to, what the consequences are. I don't want to think about the last 20 times I did this. I don't want to think about it. I want to surrender. And I think it's what you're both saying. There's a childlike surrender that we yearn for. And I think what Roberta's statement is, you know, there's a commitment. Once you get beyond that innocence, that childlike surrender, you become an adult. And an adult is the person who has the secrets, who knows the answers.
Mm-hmm. And also who is responsible and is in control. And an adult, therefore, cannot defer to a higher entity. And as if I feel that there's a part of me that is still a child, well, then there is something else out there that's bigger than I am.
I wonder if that's not the appeal of religion.
I think, in a way, the adult
who goes to religion to say...
In many ways, there are a lot of similarities between magic and religions.
Well, certainly, yeah.
Maybe I shouldn't have said that, but you know what I mean?
No, but if I believe in a God that is so almighty and big and who could do things that I don't question...
And the ritual is but an act of magic, because in the ritual, when, you know, some of the things that the priests or the religious ministers do have the same goal as magic in a way.
Certainly. No, and I think you've hit on something very poignant there. I mean, I think that, you know, look at the look at witch doctors. You know what I'm saying? These people are, you know, ambassadors of religion, and they're magicians. You know what I'm saying? I mean, they're as the embodiments or as the conduits of these higher powers, these higher forces, and they're sort of there to manifest this power here in the physical realm, and that is the definition of a magician. You know,
right.
The distinction, of course, to be made is that in the magician's case, if he is an honest magician, he's not there to pull the wool over your eyes. You know what I'm saying? He's
right.
Not saying, I am going to, you know, transform this into that, you know, because I am in touch with God and God endowed me with His power.
And I think in medicine, Armand, we see magic too with the placebo effect, for instance, you know. And again, if the patient believes that that pill is going to cure them, 50% more effective than if the patient does not believe, whether the pill is for real or not.
Yeah.
So it's the same thing.
So yeah. The belief in that which is not necessarily true leads us to falling in love, seeing magic shows, going to healers that can't heal, stopping by the people who are going to read your palm and the person with the crystal ball. All of that is because there's a kind of childlike innocence in us that wants to believe there's a power out there greater than us who does know the answer to things. And so whether it be Hashem or God or whether it be your parents or a magician, you know what I like about magicians? They're honest. Pay me $10 and come in and see me and I'll give you a show. The rest of it is so much more involved and requires so much more. On the other side of it, Roberta, let's talk for a minute about the ghosts, what we've discovered. You want to talk about this for a second?
Sure. Well, recently there's been a tremendous amount of research that's been done on brain activity, because we're discovering all sorts of things about the brain that we did not know up until now. And so some of the things that we're discovering are coming up not because we're looking for that answer, but because it comes up in the process of looking for something else. And some of the things that are coming up in that fashion are the most astounding of all. Having said that, what Armand is referring to is that we can stimulate the brains of people in such a way that the person we're working with could be perceiving a ghost-like presence, either in the form of a light or in the form of a shape or in the form of a physical presence next to them. And this is brain activity we're talking about.
We've known for years you could do smells, you could do different senses.
But there's a clear sensation that the subject that we are working with is describing the experience as experiencing a ghost, an entity that is that doesn't have a body. Now, that brings up a lot of questions in
my
mind.
What it brings up is that we now know that there are generating 12 watts of energy, which is enough of what our brain generates at every moment.
Can lit up a light bulb.
Yes, and that we have all of this energy going around in our brain, and that when, with a little bit of adaptation, a little bit of change, we can create and see things that don't exist. So seeing a ghost is not so far-fetched, because your brain will do that for you with a little short circuitry. You could even get that by being tired.
Or by being schizophrenic. By having neurological
short circuit. Right. So now you take that and you take this belief that somewhere as a child you have seen things like angels, like ghosts, like vampires, like boogeymen, like things that scare you, or things that give you wonder, or things that give you hope. And we're beginning to understand that all of these beliefs are not just fantasy, that there's a physiological process going on that actually creates the illusion. And I think, Eric, going back to what you were saying about using your five senses, I think you use your five senses plus the five senses of the audience.
Oh, of course.
And then there, without you even knowing anything about this electrical neuronal work, you somehow learn to tap into it.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it's very akin to what Roberta was saying about the... the power, pardon me, the power of suggestion and the placebo. You know, there's definitely a big element of that in a magic show. You know what I'm saying? Because if people want to believe, if they come in, ready, willing, and able to be healed of their skepticism or of their, sort of rational way of looking at the world, then if I'm doing a decent job of what I do, then they're going to it's going to have an effect on them that it wouldn't otherwise have. And that's a good thing. That's a very good thing, I think, you know.
So you may be stimulating areas of the brain in the audience that are not normally active. That's how what I'm hearing you say.
Yeah, hopefully.
Because you are doing something that's out of the ordinary, and it taps into a perceptual state that may bring up unusual perceptions.
Certainly, yes, absolutely. And also, a big element of my show, the name of the show, by the way, is Esoterica, and of course that implies that it's about esoteric things, which I hope is accurate. But what I do basically is I use various routines, sort of magic routines, sleight of hand, what have you, to hopefully illuminate or elucidate facets of philosophical ideas. So, by the very nature of the subject matter, people are thinking more in abstractions. You know what I'm saying? I've got people thinking along philosophical and metaphysical and even theological lines. And these are very abstract realms there. So that renders people even more, I think, suggestible to the idea that there is... life beyond this sort of physical realm, which I don't mean to imply necessarily that life beyond the grave, but there are sort of supersensory realms, you know what I'm saying, that we need but tap into in order to enjoy and to gain some understanding of,
There is a thrill also, I think, Armand, about being brought to the edge of mystery, because it also there's a little bit of adrenaline there, get to the edge of reality, and then what?
Oh, the way he whips up the horses. You know, at the end of the show, he's got five different things going on at the same time. And
I know.
He's proving it. He's getting you in every direction. It's brilliant. I'm certainly adrenalized and dopamined and endorphined.
Yes, the neurotransmitters are flowing.
I got everything working at that moment.
Well, you know, actually, that's it, Armand. I think that's what, ultimately, that's what we're talking about, that in this performance of Eric, that he's able to trigger secretion of neurotransmitters in people's neurological
system. Exactly what I'm trying to
say.
That's in my business plan, in fact.
I'm sure.
An intensified secretion of neurotransmitters.
It's a very good job.
Eric, what are you doing up in the Theater of Harlem?
Yeah, it's the Classical Theater of Harlem, and I will begin today rehearsals for a production of Marat Sade, a play called Marat Sade. And this will
it's
be
a big production.
It's it's a you know, it's a play that hasn't been there's been no major production of it here in New York for about 20 years. So there's a lot of excitement about it, and it's a very thrilling play. It's a political play, and it has some very interesting ideas, and it's set in an insane asylum. It'll be a cast of 60. So I'll be going from a one-man show that ran for 7 months to a cast of 60. So it will take some getting used to, but I'm very much looking forward to it. It promises to be a great production. They really do really innovative work up there at the Classical Theatre of Harlem, and Chris McElroy is the director, and he just does some amazing, amazing work. And actually, the guy who designed the set for Esoterica, which I'm sure you noticed is quite beautiful, Troy Howery, is designing the set for this thing as well. So,
right.
And he's just, you know, just such a creative fellow, and just like really, really just has an amazing aesthetic. And so I'm just really looking forward to it.
I suggest people keep track of you at ericwalton.com.
Yes, yes, yes.
ericwalton.com.
Yep, yep,
and,
yep.
You know, Eric, I wanted to ask you, where did all this love for the joy of people come from? I mean, seriously, you're clearly somebody who walks in the same neighborhood than we do. You know, we like people to feel good.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know.
Where? I mean, have you always been like this? Always as a child? You always been?
Well, you know, I'm, I love people. People are easy to love, I think, if you look in the right places. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I think that we're all, you know, flawed in our own ways, and we all have our own shortcomings and idiosyncrasies. But you know, I think that by and large, people are after the same things. You know, people want to be listened to. They want to be understood. You know, they want to be talked to. You know, as if they're intelligent. And you know, most people are intelligent, you know, and so I think that, you know, it's just a matter of trying to see the good in people, you know, to accept that we all have the same fears, we all have the same ambitions, you know, we all have the same desires and inhibitions, and you know, if you can just relate to people the way that you want people to relate to you, you know, with kindness and compassion and understanding and
were
and
you the kind of kid that put up the magic shows,
the magic shows.
At home, like for the other kids or for the family?
Not really. No, I didn't really get into magic until about 7 years ago, actually.
Really?
So I was I did it just a tiny bit when I was younger, and then I gave it up in favor of visual arts, sculpting and drawing and that sort of thing. And
I would have thought you had been doing this all your life.
Oh,
you're so good at it.
Thank you.
Wow. Did you have a master, a teacher? Did you teach yourself?
No, I've learned mostly from books. Mostly
Amazing.
From books. Yeah.
Eric, do you have a when you regard people, and when you regard people, you said something about regarding people as intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by that? How do you do that?
Well, you know, in terms of you know, my show, of course, you know, I'm always trying to speak up to people and not down to them. you know what I'm saying? Like, it's a pretty cerebral show, and it's, you know, I use a lot of fancy words, and I cover a lot of pretty esoteric terrain there. But I'm always sort of speaking to people as if they are at least as smart as, if not smarter than I am, and as if they've, you know, given these subjects some thought. And I think that most people have. Whether or not they've thought them out to a conclusion is something else entirely. But you know, we've all got, I think, you know, just about, you know, our brains are pretty much the same size. And, you know, we've all got pretty much the same potential for, you know, coming up with ingenious ideas and figuring things out. So I think that if you look at people and deal with them with that in mind, that it sort of predisposes you to speaking to them as if they are kindreds and as if they, you know, are every bit as sort of gifted or as, you know, capable as you are, you know?
Beautiful. Well, yes. I think we found our commonality, mm-hmm. and that's beautifully said. This mm-hmm. is Armand Demeaux with Roberta Maria Atti, Eric Walton at ericwalton.com, Maria Atti, Maria, Roberta Maria at...
It's creativehealthsolutions.org.
And don't forget to go to the website of WBAI, WBAI.org. It'll lead you on to all the wonderful things, and you could, of course, get a copy of today's program through our website, thepositivemind.com. Let's see how many memories we could trigger with this. And we will be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m., my friends.